Thank you, and welcome again to our weekly Awaken call. Today, we're fortunate to be in conversation with Venerable Lekshe, who's dialing in from Hong Kong this morning, or in her case, just past midnight. We're very thankful for her for doing so. And just so for some of you callers that are new to the call, the way that our call will work is we opened with a moment of silence, and then it'll be followed with a conversation with our speaker. And our amazing moderator today is going to be none other than Pavi Mehta. Then at the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A session as well as a circle of sharing where we will invite all of you to share your reflections, or if you have any questions for Venerable Lekshe, then you're more than welcome to ask. And I've gone ahead and opened up the queue right now, so if there's a question that you have at any point, feel free to hit star six, and then when we roll to the circle of sharing and Q&A session, you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. And for those of you callers that might be listening in other ways, that you're welcome to email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And you're welcome to send us in a question. We'll be happy to share your remarks or questions on your behalf. And so with that, I wanted to just jump in and say, you know, our theme this week is women in spirituality. And our guest speaker in the past, Venerable Lekshe, has noted that when we look at the evolution of the role of women that have played and what they've achieved in various fields, whether it's education, law, medicine, business, and other fields, you almost can't help but imagine, what if our society hadn't held them back for so long? Where would we be today? And though there's still a long way to go in those fields, it seems like there's an even steeper hill to climb when it comes to religion and spirituality. Often in many religions, there's this notion of God or a higher power seems to take on almost a male form, and it's the dominating paradigm in many religions, and it's what led feminist philosopher Mary Daly to once kip, you know, if God is male, then male is God. And, well, my wife has shown me many times that that's certainly not the case. And so with that, you know, just I wanted to actually start with you, Pavi, and would love to hear your perspective on what you think might be some of the barriers for women's empowerment in religion. And on a lighter note, you know, who you consider some of your female heroes in the field of spirituality.
Wonderful. Thank you, Amit. It's a big question, and I think when you look back at, you know, history and the systematic oppression and marginalization that's happened, that's a difficult legacy to overcome in a moment, you know. And I think now we often sort of maybe pay kind of lip service to the idea of equality. But it's clear across the world, you know, if you study who's at the top of organizations, how people are promoted. I mean, it's not just in religion, you know, across the field, we see this kind of discrimination. And to overcome that, I think, is work that has to be done on many different fronts. It's not just, you know, it's not just putting women in positions of power, but really equipping them, you know, with the self-confidence, with the education, with the, with sort of the social conditions that allow them to legitimately and fully step into their own power. And I think that's the work of everyone, you know, not just the feminists, and I'm sure Venerable Lekshe will speak more to this shortly, but it's certainly an urgent requirement. In terms of inspirations, I think we are fortunate to have many in the world, women that we can look up to. One person who comes to mind is Vimala Thakur, an Indian spiritual teacher as well as a social change activist, for lack of a better word. She started out in the working with the Bhutan movement of Vinoba Bhave's, and then after meeting the teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti, shifted the focus of her work more internally. But she speaks and wrote very eloquently about the need to bring together spiritual consciousness with social consciousness and action. Ani Tenzin Palmo is another woman who comes to mind, a woman in Buddhism who's remarkable work, much like Venerable Lekshe's, has done a great deal to bring the some of these inequalities and injustices to light, and has done a lot to further, not just bring the injustices to light and the need for the equality, but then also on the positive front, actually working to create that that change in the form of nunneries and promoting education for women. Monastics in the Buddhist tradition is another hero who comes to mind. And of course, Venerable Lekshe herself.
Wonderful. Well, that just seems like a ripe opportunity for you to go ahead and introduce her, and love to hear her perspective on this and many of the other things that you have in mind.
Perfect. Well, it's an intimidating task to introduce someone like this, so I'm going to try and make it short and sweet and then pass it over. But, you know, this is someone, Venerable Karma Lekshe Somo's life, it's followed an unusual trajectory, to say the very least. She grew up surfing the waves in Malibu and grew up to discover an unexpected calling in a spiritual tradition from the other side of the world, in Buddhism. In 1977, she received the precepts of a novice nun and 5 years later received full ordination. The immense challenges she experienced and witnessed as a woman monastic would shape the course of her work. She is the founder of Sakyadita International Association of Buddhist Women and the director of the Jamyang Foundation, an innovative education project for women in developing countries. She's also a professor of Buddhist studies at the University of San Diego, and her published work includes Sisters in Solitude, Two Traditions of Monastic Ethics for Women, and a number of edited volumes on women in Buddhism. Her work also has explored deeply the fields of death and dying, and she has supported and started nunneries across the Himalayas, and now splits her time between, I think it is San Diego, India, and Hong Kong, and many other parts of the world. It's an honor to have you with us, Venerable Lekshe. I wanted to track back a little bit and begin with just, you know, the question that's probably on everyone's minds is how did the surfer child in you, the surfer woman in you, get to be where you are today? What were some of the early influences in your life that perhaps foreshadowed this calling?
Oh, it's a big question. Well, yes, I think one thing that was sort of a birthright was being born into a family with the name Zen. So it's spelled Z-E-N-N, but it sounds like Zen Buddhism. So the kids at school used to tease me about being a Zen Buddhist, and then I started to read about it. So that was definitely an important influence in my life, just having all these questions as a kid about life and death and, you know, meaning, and then reading a book that just completely resonated. And in those days, this is way back in the 50s, there wasn't much literature about Buddhism available. There weren't, you know, a lot of temples. There weren't any temples. There weren't teachers. There were no guides on the path. So finding a couple of books was about the best I could do at that time. And it really, awakened something in me and got me started. But it still wasn't so easy, because there was such a lack of information, no one to ask questions of. Then I think, you know, growing up in Malibu was, of course, a great privilege, and it was not really wonderful to be growing up in the country, countryside, you know, where we were surfing every day. We'd spend, well, really the whole day in the water in the summer. And being in nature all the time. You know, Malibu was undeveloped at that time. So roaming the canyons and discovering all kinds of waterfalls and rocks and trees and all kinds of things. I think I was very fortunate to have that kind of environment. I remember very clearly losing two dogs on the Pacific Coast Highway. And, you know, it's a treacherous highway, and so busy we couldn't really go out on the weekends because the traffic was so heavy. You could get to the beach by going under a tunnel to the underneath the road. But when my doggy Scampi got killed on Pacific Coast Highway, it really sort of shattered my world because I hadn't really experienced anything like that before. And really woke me up to the concept of suffering. It opened up a whole new, you know, sort of raft of questions about, you know, where did Scampi go? You know, I was really still quite young, and so it was kind of a shock. And that question of what happens to us after we die has followed me all the way through until today. So I count that as a really important influence, too. I kept asking people what happens to us after we die and not really getting any satisfactory answers until eventually, I was 19, I dropped out of Occidental College, like Obama, and got on a ship with my surfboard to Japan and went to from San Francisco to Honolulu and then Honolulu to Yokohama and started surfing there. And when it started snowing, then I went to a monastery and started meditating. So I was searching for a teacher, which took many years to find. And after a couple of years in Asia, I went back to Berkeley, was lucky to study Buddhism with Lewis Lancaster, and then went out, went back to India and to Dharamsala. By this time, His Holiness the Dalai Lama had started the Tibetan Library there. Mm-hmm. So there were actually teachers there. And finally, you know, it was really quite miraculous that the first day that I had to start my classes, because I was on an East-West Center grant, I had to start that day. I ran down the mountain and burst into the classroom, and here's this little lama sitting on a cushion at the far end of the classroom on the floor, and he was explaining exactly what happens to us after we die. It was quite remarkable. And so I sat at his seat for 6 years and learned everything that I could. And so, you know, it's just taken off from there. The last 10, 20 years, then I've been following that question.
We really jump right into the heart of it, starting out with death. I like it.
Right.
And I was listening to an interview last night, and I made the mistake of, you know, it was an interview with you, actually, on death, right before I was, you know, going to go to sleep, and it left me feeling more awake than ever. Just a note to anyone out there.
Good. Awake is good.
Exactly. It was wonderful. And I remember one line that leapt out at me was, you said something, I might be, you know, paraphrasing a little bit, but something to the effect of dying is the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yes. That's not original, actually. I think it might have been Stephen Levine that came up with this concept of death as the opportunity of a lifetime. But when you think of it, in a sense, it is. Now, of course, this is all sort of based on the concept of rebirth, which is probably accepted by a third of people in the world, at least, that we don't live just once, but we live, again and again, in different forms. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, we don't always you know, take rebirth as a human being. Could be in any form. But it means that the moment of death is really a special one because, in a sense, the state of mind we're in when we die is the trajectory, or it is the cause for whatever comes after. So it means if we were to die in great anger, for example, then that would influence our consciousness in a rather unfortunate way. Whereas if we were to die in a mindset of loving kindness and compassion, awareness, wisdom, then that would condition our mindset in a very positive, special way that could actually engender awakening, perfect awakening. Mm-hmm. So it's a very special moment. We have to be very careful. We have to take care.
Mm-hmm. That's precious. I wonder if, you know, for people, say, who may not subscribe to that theory of reincarnation, I still feel like there is something tremendous about just holding that awareness of death, which is not something as a culture we're very good at doing. You know, just that reality, I think, is one that we do our best to hide and then create this sort of illusion of, you know, we're going to be here forever. And we live that way. And yet, what do you think is the power of living with a very daily and almost as a practice, an awareness of the reality of death?
Well, I think it wakes us up to the moment, for sure. Because, as you say, we're often in denial about the reality of death. And as a result, we fritter away the life, you know, the moments, the precious moments that we have in silly stuff, and sort of meaningless activities for the most part. And that also sets the frame for how we die. So if we're alive to the moment, we're going to use these precious moments in the most meaningful, positive way we can. And so death awareness is really important. They say, if the Tibetans say, if we don't meditate on death in the morning, we waste the day. If we don't meditate on death in the evening, we waste the night. So rather than think of this as something morbid, yes, it's a way of recalling that our lifetime is limited, you know, that makes us more sort of conscious of the preciousness of each passing moment, not just each passing day, but each passing moment. So that grounds us, continually brings us back to the moment, and we can be fully aware of each precious moment instead of like spacing out and, you know, wasting our life and then we die.
That really resonates, and you know, I was thinking about it, and I haven't had too many, maybe one time that I can remember where I wasn't sure whether I was going to make it through. But as I've, you know, read and listened to some of your stories, I think one of the remarkable things is that you've had, death has come calling several times almost in your life. And, could you speak a little bit to those experiences and what that, you know, how maybe just having this theoretical understanding of, you know, holding death is kind of this, you know, concept in your head versus the experience of it in your, the, you know, experience of that possibility viscerally in you?
Well, I have lived a bit dangerously, not, you know, as a conscious choice, but just because, you know, traveling up into the Himalayas every summer, you go over these treacherous roads, and it's life is really precarious. I mean, buses regularly go over the edge, and, you know, jeeps crash and burn and or get caught under avalanches. All kinds of things can happen up there. And then also, you know, going through war zones where anything can happen. And traveling up into the Himalayas beyond Ladakh during the Kashmir crisis, you know, and you just ask the guards, is there shooting ahead? And if there's no shooting ahead, you know, you just travel by day and then ask to make sure that there's not, you know, no conflict on the roads. But I guess one of the closest calls I had was the snake bite. I got bitten by a snake while walking in the forest in northern India. And I didn't see the snake. I just had a really creepy feeling about the place. And then made it back to the monastery, but you know, something was radically wrong. And the next morning, the Tibetan doctor, Yeshe Dindin, who's quite well known, he's written a couple of books that have been translated, found the bite. And he couldn't immediately recognize what it was. It could have been a spider, it could have been a scorpion, or it could have been a snake. But he immediately raced off and got some special medicine. And the Tibetans have really good medicine for poisons. So I took that immediately, and I had never seen him do something like that, diagnose someone and race off himself to get the medicine and bring back the glass of water to take it immediately. So I guess it was pretty, you know, critical moment there. And I think that it actually, it must have saved my life, because usually people get bitten by a viper, they die immediately. And so in this case, I didn't die instantly, but got gangrene because there were no proper hospitals up in the mountains there. And by the time I, 8 days later, by the time I got to a proper hospital in Delhi, you know, the gangrene was really serious. They had to cut off a lot of, well, I won't go into all the gory details, but it was really close call. And so I went through a period of 3 months not knowing from day to day whether I would be alive tomorrow. And even though I had already been meditating for many years at that time, because, you know, with the last name Zen, whether I was meditating or just spacing out, I'm not completely sure, but, you know, I'd fancied I was meditating all those years. But, you know, it's really different when you're in a life and death situation. When you're in great pain, it's not so easy to concentrate. As I'd, you know, I'd figured I was in pretty, you know, pretty good shape. I was ready to die. But, I never factored in the pain that you might be experiencing. Now, some people might be lucky and sort of pass into the night with no pain, no discomfort, but we can't guarantee that. So, and then also, the hospital staff was giving me all these medications. Well, I didn't know what they were. They just come along with a big handful of meds, and they just give you a glass of water, and you're supposed to take them. But I didn't know what was in them. And one day, I said, what's in this stuff? And they said, oh, don't worry, it's just Valium. Okay. Wow, that's really bad for your mind. So that the drugs can also dull your awareness. Whereas at the moment of death, we want to be conscious whether we believe there's anything after the moment of death or not. We still want to be awake and aware, if possible, right? To do the best that we can in that moment. And if you're sedated, then it really sort of dulls your awareness. And anyway, so eventually, I mean, I made it. And that experience was meaningful and important in many ways. I mean, you understand the power of loving kindness. You recognize how utterly dependent we are on other beings. and so many things, you know, impermanence, up close and personal. So I'm really grateful. I wouldn't want to go through it again, but I feel fortunate to have had the experience.
Sounds tremendous. I can't imagine 3 months of being at that doorstep and not knowing and still having a grounding in your practice. Invaluable. And I was thinking back to one of the stories I heard yesterday of you speaking about how when you were 11 and your brother was 12 or vice versa, you'd gone out, you were both swimming, and there was a storm warning and you were swept out, and both of you, I think it was for several hours. You were out there. The one line that you said that stuck out was that, you know, you'd both made your peace with that to some degree, and and this was, you know, prior, I imagine, to all of your kind of practice and your study of Buddhism, and I think that was remarkable to me, to think of that, the, you know, a child being in that position and finding that that wisdom, you know, that wise response. Though I'm sure it was terrifying also.
Yeah, but, I mean, when you face death, you really have no choice. It's not like you can decide. Well, we tried swimming back in, but every wave was bigger than the next. We would have gotten completely whomped if we tried to go back into shore. And the waves just kept coming in bigger and bigger and bigger. Fortunately, we were strong swimmers, so we just kept diving under one wave, and the next one was bigger than that, and on and on and on, until we were 3/4 of a mile offshore. It was one of the biggest storms that had hit Malibu. And then we were searching for alternatives, how we might be able to get back to shore. And there, a lot of the coastline there is full of rocks. And Malibu Beach, where you get a nice, you know, wave in, was miles away. So we were trying to hold on to the kelp. And we made peace with not only with the situation, but with each other. You know, two kids that grew up together and, you know, and then we just, it was really like facing it head on. And it was quite terrifying. It was also quite beautiful.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, then a fishing boat came along, and we were waving like crazy to try to get picked up. And the crew ignored us. Just two little kids, yeah? And, and off they went, you know. Fortunately, someone on the shore had seen us go out in the storm warning, which we didn't know it was storm warning. Mm-hmm. And they'd called the Coast Guard. So after a couple of hours, we got picked up by a Coast Guard boat, yeah. And rescued, which was really lucky because it could have been all over for us.
It must have been terrifying for your mother, I'm sure.
She completely freaked out.
I think that what leaps out to me, I think it's just that, you know, there's something very inspiring about the fact that there is that place of equanimity, of acceptance, of, you know, of strength, really, that we can access in those moments. So I guess the lesson I take away is that the more that we're cultivating that in the, you know, on the pleasant days when the storm warning hits, like we're going to have better access to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily come naturally. Normally we need to train in it because our minds are quite distracted typically. Right? Specialize in distraction. As long as we're distracted by this, that, and the other thing, then we don't have to think about what's really important, which, you know, the whole big questions, the great matters of life and death. So we normally distract ourselves with all kinds of stuff. And then when the time comes, we're not prepared. So I think that learning to find that peace inside ourselves, or equanimity, as the Buddhists might say, then we always know that we can come back to that place of peace inside, no matter what's going on outside. We have that refuge inside where we can calm down. We know how to do it, right?
Right.
No matter how chaotic, crazy things get, we know how we can get to that place of peace. So very useful, very practical.
Wonderful, thank you. I want to shift gears slightly here to talk a little bit about what that experience was for you as a, you know, you'd grown up in a Western tradition and you were following, you were stepping into this, you know, this life as a Buddhist nun. Were you prepared for some of the discrimination or the, you know, what you saw as the inequality later? Was that something you were aware of before you went in or not? And if so, what was that, you know, how did that initial period feel like to you, and what became clear?
Well, I think the growth of my own feminist awareness came rather slowly, in a sense. I mean, growing up in a family where my brother was privileged, I noticed inequalities very starkly. But I didn't know to question it. I assumed that this is the way the world worked and that I would just have to get used to it. Right. It never occurred to me in those early years to question it or to challenge it. And I could say the same thing in becoming a Buddhist and studying in traditionally Buddhist cultures. I also, in the beginning, I can't say that I really noticed the gender inequalities. It wasn't until later that it started to dawn on me. I started to wake up to the reality that I didn't have the same opportunities as the men did. And then
and
try
how
to
did
come
that manifest?
To some,
sorry to interrupt. How did that
well,
manifest?
Well, yeah. So, well, there were lots of monasteries for men in India, you know, after the communists took over Tibet. And His Holiness Dalai Lama fled to India along with about 100,000 refugees. And they almost immediately set about establishing monastic centers in India. Today there are over 300 monastic centers. But very few for women. There were, in the beginning there were none. And I remember in the mid-70s, they a group of nuns started a community in Dharamsala. So there were a few nuns living in the jungle down in Orissa, a couple, you know, living together up in Darjeeling, but really there was no place for a woman to go, and especially for studies. So the monasteries were always the learning centers in Tibet and in most Buddhist societies, and those learning centers were not open to women. Women were systematically excluded from these great learning centers. And so it meant that my classmates, once they learned Tibetan, could go down to South India and just check into one of these amazing monastic learning centers. But there was no place for me to go. Women were not welcome there. I remember very clearly asking my teacher, well, why don't I just go down to Sarah Monastery? And he said, you wouldn't be happy and they wouldn't be happy. There really was no place for women in those centers. So eventually we had to start our own monastery. So that's one solution. And now there are, you mentioned Venerable Tenzing Palmo's monastery, and That's a recent option. We started in about 1987 because at the Tibetan Library, which is established by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Western people had an opportunity to study the great Buddhist texts, most of which are Indian texts. And then we could also study Tibetan language. And then eventually, you know, we just kept learning, and it was amazing. Living conditions were really harsh in those days, but the quality of the education we got was spectacular. And then once we learned Tibetan, all the men would all go down to South India, and there was no place for us to go. And for the Himalayan women as well, there were no learning centers for them. So that's when we started the first project with Jamyang Chuling in Dharamsala. And then nuns started coming down from the mountains and saying, oh, couldn't we establish something up in our homelands? And then we started one after the other until now there are 12, 13 centers, education centers. They're practice centers and learning centers. But the problem we face is that there aren't enough teachers, mm-hmm. because the monasteries for the monks are not open, and so we're pretty much dependent on male teachers. And up in the hardship areas, it's very difficult to get teachers. So we're hoping that women, as they get educated, will develop as teachers, and they already are. This is what's so wonderful to see, is that women emerging as teachers, gaining confidence. There's something about education that really builds someone's consciousness, whether it's, you know, girls or boys or whomsoever. By being educated, you have a certain independence, a certain, you know, faith in your own abilities that it's difficult when you haven't had the chance to study. So that's what we see happening now. It's like watching flowers blossom. Really beautiful.
Beautiful analogy. I wanted to get your perspective on, the origins of women's entry into Buddhism. It wasn't smooth even, at the very beginning. And, from what we know today, the Buddha allowed women to ordain, but it was some years after the monastic order had been established for men, and he'd had requests from his aunt as well as Ananda, who took up the cause. And there's the story of him refusing three times and then opening up that opportunity, and also the prophecy of it having a shortening effect on the length of the sasana. And could you speak a little bit to what, you know, what from your perspective the Buddha's views on women were, and how that historically has played out?
Well, we can't know for sure what the Buddha's views on women were, because the texts were all written down long after the Buddha was no longer in this world. So we only have the texts, which were transmitted orally by monks for hundreds of years before being committed to writing. So in those texts, it tells the story that you just narrated about the Buddha's stepmother, actually, Mahapajapati, his foster mother, requesting admission to the Sangha, the monastic order. And the Buddha, in my reading, he did not flatly refuse, but he hesitated. He basically said, please don't ask. Please don't ask. Please don't ask. So the latest research, there's a German scholar named Analeo, and he's documented, he's come to the conclusion that this is really for the protection of the women. Because the wandering lifestyle, the sannyasin lifestyle, can be quite dangerous for women. Not only at that time, but even today. Mm-hmm. So I think this German scholar concludes that the Buddha was recommending that women stay at home and practice in the home. They could maintain a celibate lifestyle and concentrate on the practice, but not sleeping under trees, because sleeping under trees was was dangerous for women. So, but eventually, when he saw the determination of Mahaprajapati, then, and Ananda's argument, well, you know, she took care of you, she nursed you since you were a small child. I mean, out of kindness, basically, it was appealing to the Buddha's loving kindness. Wouldn't it be well that she were allowed to join the Sangha? And he agreed. And the kicker was when he asked, do women have the potential to realize the fruits of the path? And that would mean liberation or awakening. And the Buddha said, oh yes, women have the potential to achieve the fruits of the path. In other words, he was asserting the equal spiritual potential of women. So that's an amazing statement. And it's been very encouraging, I think, for women. In fact, it even leads to this idea that men and women are equal in Buddhism. Well, in theory, yes, I think we could say as long as a being has consciousness, then that being has the potential to purify the consciousness and thereby achieve awakening, whether male or female or other, right? Whatever gender category one might fall in. But of course, the social reality is quite a different story. Social realities don't necessarily mean that women have opportunities to study the teachings. It doesn't mean they normally don't have the same level of support to be able to go into retreat for a long time, for example. So the other story that there's several, that the price of her admission to the Sangha was to accept 8 special rules or 8 weighty rules, which definitely made the nun's order subordinate to the monk's order. And then the other piece, which is the prediction that the life of the Buddha's teachings, sasana, would diminish, the duration of the teachings would be shortened. If women are admitted to the Sangha, then the Dharma will only last for 500 years. But what we see is that after 500 years, the teachings are still going strong, then the texts start to read, if women are admitted to the Sangha, then the sasana will only last 1,000 years. Then after 1,000 years, they start to read, if women are admitted to the Sangha, the teachings will die out after 1,500 years. And this goes on and on, right? Until here we are 2,500 years later, and Buddhism is alive and well. So clearly, these teachings were not set in stone. Probably, I mean, the case of the 8 special rules, it's very clear that it was not spoken by the Buddha, but was inserted artificially in that text several hundred years later, probably. But be that as it may, because of those stories, it's put women at a disadvantage. You know, the idea that the Buddha hesitated to admit women makes it look like there's something wrong with women, that, you know, women are facing some kind of, handicap. Yeah. And that leads to these kinds of beliefs that women are inferior, that women have bad karma, and so on. The idea that women threaten the life of the teachings, wow, that's major. And so that's also sort of been used, I think, against women. The idea that women are subordinate to the monk's order and more or less dependent on the monk's order has also been a disadvantage. So in the modern world now, all of this is being rethought, reimagined, reexamined, right? Yeah. Because all these texts are open to interpretation.
It's so encouraging and really enlightening to sort of hear your perspective on all of this. I think for many of us who who have read, you know, the text and heard that history, it does sting a little bit, and so to be able to put it in this kind of perspective is invaluable. One thing I wanted to ask, and this I think relates to any field of activism, not just of feminism, but I think what's remarkable about the work that you've done, and kind of that, you know, it's an uphill journey, I'm sure, and to reverse the tide of a lot of these biases is not easy work, and yet to do it with a kind of the lightness and the joy and the loving kindness that you do is extraordinary, because I think in many fields of activism, the energy is really fueled almost by a kind of anger or bitterness. And how, I guess, what would your, you know, advice be to people who are, whatever their field might be, trying to effect, you know, social change, working against unfair systems, maybe without adding to that internal baggage?
Yeah, well, that's a really important question. And I think that, you know, for the Buddhists, the idea would be to always try to maintain this kind of equanimity, loving kindness, compassion, balanced with wisdom as well. So, you know, during the 60s in Berkeley, I was a student. Actually, I was trying to read Japanese poetry, and they get tear gassing us out of classes. So it's kind of a wake-up call for all of us. And we could see that in many cases there were provocateurs who were sent to outrage the crowds. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd be marching quietly, happily along, and suddenly there'd be someone appear out of nowhere and start shouting death to the pigs or something like that. And, who are you? Where did these people come from? That wasn't what we were about at all. And yet, you could see how easily a crowd could be maneuvered, manipulated into a violent response. And I think we see that even today. There are, it's very, very important to maintain calm in social activism, both for one's own mental health, but also for the success of the movement. The minute somebody loses it, that's what gets on the news, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like in Seattle, 250,000 people march peacefully, happily, quietly. What gets on the news? The 8 broken windows. Mm-hmm. So it behooves us as social activists to maintain calm. And we really should be getting more training and practice in that kind of nonviolent social activism, nonviolent communications, so that because just like preparing for death, we have to prepare for untoward circumstances. And to do that well, we have to practice. Right? Well, so that's what meditation is, basically. Meditation's practice, a preparation for real life. When we sit on the cushion, even if it's only 5 or 10 minutes, we're getting centered, we're calming, we're getting used to mm-hmm. being calm, being peaceful, right? Being concentrated, centered. The word in Tibetan for meditation is gom, means to get used to. So we get used to virtue, we get used to this calm, quiet, peaceful state of mind. So that's the norm. We actually get in touch with our own basic sanity, our own basic clarity. And then we know what that looks like. Then we can always come back to it, right? And so, yeah, that's part of the process. I think it's very practical. Spirituality for men and for women is very important, even necessary for being an effective social activist. The thing about rage is, Okay, from a Buddhist point of view, first of all, it's really bad karma to get angry, which is totally, you know, contrary to certain theories. But for Buddhists, getting angry is unfortunate. So in training in patience, loving kindness, and compassion, we have the antidotes, we have the tools for dealing with anger, with rage. Rage is very draining. It's also a very uncomfortable sensation, a very unhappy situation. And it causes a lot of problems. When we're angry, we say things we don't mean. We do things that we ordinarily wouldn't do. I mean, people even kill each other out of anger. So it's really important, I think, for everyone to train in patience. The Buddhists actually have a meditation where they send loving kindness to all the people that are giving them trouble. You know, whoever they traditionally call the enemy, but, you know, whoever's giving you grief, put that person in the very center of your loving kindness meditation. Right? And then the person no longer has the power over you that can make you angry. And it has the effect of diffusing these potential conflict situations. Really brilliant method.
Sounds so like the need of the hour for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Practice along that edge. Venerable Lexi, I wanted to ask you to speak a little bit about Sakyadita, the International Association of Buddhist Women, and the, you know, I understand they put on a conference every year. Could you share the kind of the origins of this? And I believe there's a story around the first donation that you received.
Oh, yeah. Right. This a Texan woman, a former actress and a filmmaker, got lost in the forest outside my little mud hut. And I hear this call in the night, "Help, help, help me, I'm lost." And I went out and found her and led her back to the hotel. And then the next day ran into her in the village. Well, we'd had this idea of having a gathering of Buddhist women because we recognized that all of us were facing the same sorts of problems, a lack of encouragement, a lack of facilities, a lack of opportunities. And we thought we'd get together and talk about it. And when I told her about this idea, she said, "Oh, I think that's a great idea. When are you going to get together?" I said, "Oh, in January." And she said, "Well, how much money do you have for putting that conference on?" I said, "Oh, we don't have any money." She said, "Oh, well, what if I lent you $5,000? I said, "Well, you don't even know me." She said, "I know you." And I said, "Well, that's really very kind of you. But what if the conference is not successful and we can't pay back the money?" She said, "Well, then we'll call it a gift." So, wow. So there we had the seed money to put on this conference, which attracted several hundred people. In fact, the opening ceremony with the Dalai Lama was 1,500. And you know, I was it was something really new. People didn't know what I was doing. Some of the monks found it quite threatening to see all these women getting together. And it was Bodh Gaya, you know, it was a very poor village. And we put on a sanghadana, like an offering, a lunch offering for all the abbots in town, which are, of course, all men. We had about 100 people sitting down at the same table with the nuns. Oh, that was really groundbreaking. There were so many groundbreaking things. And nuns welcoming the Dalai Lama with horns, you know, the traditional horns and all of this. Well, after a week of our discussions and then a week-long tour, actually, of the Buddha's sacred sites, we do all the accounting, and it comes out, we made our expenses exactly, and I was able to repay the $5,000. So almost every conference, we have one every 2 years, and it's all run by volunteers, everything we do. So we wanted to continue the conversation. After that first conference, we decided to establish Sakyadita as an international association of Buddhist women, Sakyadita meaning daughters of the Buddha. And then we've continued since then. Very little support on a financial level, but lots of encouragement and inspiration from all these wonderful women. In particular, also a lot of male allies. And that's been very important. And so it grows and grows, and now we're holding our 14th Sakyadita conference this year at the last week of June in Indonesia. So the idea was to create links among the Buddhist women of the world. And there's something like, well, we were saying 300 million Buddhist women. But actually, the people in China said, oh, no, wait a second, we've got 300 million. So we sort of had to double our numbers here. But if so, that's a tremendous force for peace in the world. If you got 600 people already dedicated to peace and, you know, the well-being of living creatures and all of this, then maybe we could save the world. So we continue, and these conferences are open to everyone. They're open to men and women and lay people and monastics and people of all religious backgrounds, no religious background, from all different, you know, cultures and countries and language groups. And we try to provide translation in as many languages as possible. We even had Hindi and Marathi at the last conference in Vaishali. Yeah, Vaishali is the village where the Buddhist foster mother became the first Buddhist nun. It was quite historical. Yeah, so that was really great. So that's what we're up to.
Wonderful. I want to emphasize that, like, with this work that you've done, you know, so much of it is around education, you know, and empowering kind of the development of women. And across the board, that's been seen, you know, when we're talking about development, community development, societal development, the most effective way has been proven time and again to start with the women, to start with education, you know, giving young women opportunities to learn, increasing their access. So the ripple effect of this work, I think, is extraordinary. And I know you have another foundation, the Jamyang Foundation, which I believe Charity Focus helped build the first website for that.
We're still using that same website. We haven't found someone to update it, but we're so grateful. Yeah, it's still up there. You can see it.
And
we've,
Go ahead. I just wanted to ask what the name means.
Oh, Jiamyang. Jiamyang means Manjushri in Tibetan. So Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom, said to be the embodiment of all the Buddha's wisdom. So we took that name because it's a study center. And Chiling means, Chiling is like Dharmadhatu, it means a place where Dharma can happen, a space, you could say. So that's the meaning of the name. And that's grown organically since 1987. Right after the conference, we thought, well, you know, we've really got to help these women out. And in Buddhist cultures, you know, if people are really serious about Buddhism, they usually want to be a monastic. They want they dive in, you know, head first, and decide to make a lifetime sort of commitment of it. And so a lot of it has been, nuns have been at the center of this, though we'd welcome lay women, lay people. But so we started with a program just to sort of learn the Buddhist texts. And first it started actually with literacy, because as I mentioned, a lot of the women in those days were illiterate, especially the nuns who walked out of Tibet. They could not read and write. their own language. And this is the language that the texts are written in. So imagine becoming a nun, making a lifelong commitment to practicing the Dharma and yet not being able to read the Dharma text. Again, we take for granted so many of the privileges we enjoy, like literacy. So the first program was 11 nuns learning to read, and they were ranged in age from 36 to 63. And all of them learned to read within 2 months.
Oh my goodness.
That was remarkable. Then they came and said, oh, well, could we learn Tibetan grammar? Okay, so I went out and found a grammar teacher for them. And then they said, well, could we learn philosophy and debate? Okay, now that was harder. It was very hard to find a monk who would come and teach philosophy and debate. And, you know, in a small village society, the reasons aren't far to see. You know, like, what's the monk doing in the nunnery, right? It sets up, you know, some gossip and so on. So they were pretty hesitant. But finally, a young monk that I knew personally agreed to come and teach the nuns philosophy and debate. Well, then an English woman came and said, well, do you think they'd like to learn English? I said, well, but I have no idea. They were, you know, not versed in their own language until a couple months ago, but I'll ask them. So I asked them, would you like to learn English? Oh, yes, they wanted to learn English. So in this way, within a few short months, we had a full-time study program. And that's what's continued and actually taken root and then given off shoots in many Himalayan regions where women had no place to go. So it offers women an alternative to marriage and family, which is an age-old tradition in India. And it's... Yeah, it gives them an alternative. You know, and marriage and family is a really wonderful thing. It's necessary for a human society. But up in these regions where there's so little food, in these days there's precious little water, there's no health care. So women give birth, you know, every year with no medical care. And there's a lot of suffering that goes on, watching their children die for, you know, preventable reasons and so forth. So I think it's natural that some young people, you know, they see this, the Buddha's teachings in stark reality all around them, and they think, oh, yeah, you know, it's time to get off the wheel. And so they want to study Buddhism. So both boys and girls... And yet the girls never had the opportunity before, and now they do. So we just wanted to make that available for... It's always a very small percentage of the population that chooses to dedicate themselves fully to the spiritual path. I mean, celibacy has been an option since the beginning of time, but precious few people take advantage of the opportunity. So... it's not like everyone's going to run off to the monastery by any means. But at least for those who are inclined to the spiritual path and want to do it full time, well, now they have the option. So,
incredibly important work.
So that's the story.
Probably, I was hoping to jump in here for a second. I wanted to give some of our callers an opportunity. Obviously, it's just been an incredible conversation so far, but I know that we might have some callers that are listening in that have some questions for us.
Hi, this is Kozo from Cupertino. And I just want to thank Venerable Lekshe for sharing her wisdom. But I specifically wanted to ask about how surfing played a role or influenced her spiritual path. And if that's too specific, then perhaps how like the Hawaiian concept of aina, which is the spirit of the land, influenced her spiritual journey in either Hawaii or Bodh Gaya or Himalayas or Dharamsala.
Good one. Okay. I think that surfing was really spiritual for me as a child because, you know, you're out there in the middle of the ocean. It's very quiet. It's it's very peaceful. Between sets, right? You have a lot of time for reflection. You also get a new perspective on life, because instead of seeing the busyness of your everyday thing, you sort of can see the whole landscape, the whole coast, right? And it really changes your way of looking at the world. So I feel very fortunate about that. And of course, that's connected with the concept of the Aina, because you get an appreciation for the land. And in the 50s, you know, the beaches were still quite pristine. And then gradually, we started to see developers coming in, both in California and Hawaii, and messing up the Aina. Actually, they were messing with our surfing spots. I mean, we were kids, right? So that was the first thing we thought of. But later, when I realized, it gave me an appreciation for the earth itself and the earth as our home. And made me realize that we're all sort of embedded in this wonderful earth that we share. And so, of course, the Hawaiian wisdom on that, I learned it even further by living in Hawaii for many years. And you really get an appreciation for it. Also an appreciation for the attachment that some people have to the land. Now, being sort of rootless, some of us who moved every few years, then we don't necessarily have those kinds of roots. But I gained an appreciation for the perspectives of people who are very closely grounded in a particular culture, in a particular place, in a particular village. This would help us to understand a lot of the conflicts that are going on in the world today. You know, why the Tibetans are sad to have lost their country, why the Palestinians are sad to have lost their country. You see, I mean, it helps to explain why people get upset about things like that. So I think in many ways it was valuable. Good question.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we actually had one of our callers email us a question, and the question is, Venerable Lekshe, I wanted to ask why celibacy has been such a central role to the deep practice of Buddhism. Is this related to just choosing between the life of a householder versus a monastic, or is there a physical, emotional impact of living a celibate life? Thanks for your response.
Okay, I think it has many benefits, both spiritually and psychologically and so forth. You will notice that in almost every religious tradition, there is it's more pronounced in certain traditions. Say the Roman Catholic monastic tradition, the Hindu sannyasin tradition, and the Buddhist monastic tradition. The Taoists also, many practice celibacy. First of all, it saves energy. It saves energy that can be directed to spiritual practice. Second, it saves time, because relationship requires a lot of time and also energy. And then family life is really important, really precious. It takes a great deal of time. So I think that a celibate lifestyle allows one to live either singly or in a community and just totally focus on spiritual practice. Of course, after we meditate on the mountain for some years, we come back to society, that's for sure. And I'm not saying it's an easy path either. In Thailand, for example, they have a kind of temporary ordination. So you can go into the monastery for a year or a month or, these days even a week, and get a taste of what monastic life is like. So learning to sort of sublimate desire is an age-old spiritual practice. So there's a lot more to be said, but that's kind of the basics, yeah?
Great. Thank you for that. I just had a personal question as well for you, in terms of when you were first going down the path yourself and starting learning to meditate, What kind of challenges did you come across, both, you know, internally and externally, whether it was people, friends, or family around you that were questioning the path that you were on, or your own doubts and questions that were coming up from inside?
Well, of course, the first, you know, the people around me weren't at all into this kind of thing. You know, my father's an engineer, my mother's a Christian fundamentalist. There was no encouragement whatsoever for following the spiritual path, this kind of spiritual path. So that was daunting. Also, I mentioned the lack of teachers, a lack of guidance. I thought I was meditating. Now looking back, I think I was probably just mental wandering. I didn't know what I was doing, right? And there weren't even books to help guide. Like today, there's shelves and whole walls full of books on spiritual practice and meditation and all of this. But at that time, there was nothing. Then internally, I think the biggest challenge was that I wanted to go faster. I wanted to get on with it. But I still was bogged down in all of these sort of worldly entanglements. You know, all of it. You know, all the social stuff that goes on. And, you know, just like, oh, all the distractions. So I really wanted to put it away and just go for it, but I didn't know how. And it took many years to learn to sort of be patient with the process. And then I was fortunate also to find these wonderful, wonderful teachers in India. So that was a great gift.
I'm curious, you know, you had mentioned that the conference you had put together and the Dalai Lama had come there. What the Dalai Lama's viewpoint has been on women in Buddhism and in roles of whether as nuns or taking being accepted throughout the entire tradition.
Well, he's been really encouraging. I mean, I think from the beginning, as soon as, you know, he realized that the nuns were, I mean, I'm not sure that he realized exactly the situation of the nuns until, you know, we started to sort of share some of this with him. He didn't know how hard it was for the nuns. And then he's really made some very clear supportive statements, especially encouraging the nuns to get better educated. Also, he constantly praises the roles of mothers. He sees mothers as a symbol of loving kindness. He talks almost every time the subject comes up. You know, he had a wonderful mother. Even though he didn't live with his mother after a certain age, but he always had a very close relationship with this amazing woman. And so he says that we know that human beings are naturally loving because even from the time they're first born, they reach out with love to their mothers. And that we should always remember the kindness of the mother. We should always remember to repay the kindness of the mother. So even if we have a difficult, rocky relationship with our mother, we can't deny how much we owe our mothers just for giving us, I mean, because they gave us life, not just, but because they gave us life, this precious human opportunity. So he's made many very supportive statements, including supporting the establishment of an ordination, a lineage, a full ordination for women. Now, the Tibetan tradition doesn't have a lineage, a full ordination for women. We have to go to other traditions, like I went to Korea for full ordination. But he encouraged me, and several of my teachers encouraged me. So the problem is that this technicality of monastic law, how to get the thing started, and to the extent that he organized, you know, he asked us to form a committee, 5 Western nuns, and he just won a peace prize in Switzerland, 50,000 Swiss francs. He gave us this money and said, you know, I want you to meet and figure out a way to get this done. So we've been meeting the last eight or 9 years and doing the research on trying to find a method that would be acceptable even to the most conservative of the senior monks. So, yes, I mean, he always encourages us. And I'm quite confident that we will be able to establish full ordination for women. Actually, you know, it's a religious right. If women don't have equal religious rights, then they don't have equal human rights. That's just logical. So we're working on it.
That's great. I'm going to go to one of our callers.
Hello, and thank you for speaking with us today. I'm an American. I'm living in Grand Cayman at the moment. And my question revolves around what the meaning of Dharma is in terms of my life. What's my Dharma? I'm clear about what my spiritual Dharma is in the deepest sense. I'm less clear about that at more a day-to-day level. And really appreciated your comment just a few minutes ago about being patient with the process of clarity about that unfolding. And I was wondering if there are some comments about these concepts.
Yes. Well, the word Dharma has many levels of meaning. In the Hindu tradition, it has certain levels of meaning. In the Buddhist tradition, it has even, you know, further levels of meaning. So Dharma as your own personal path is one meaning. In the Buddhist tradition, it generally means the teachings of the Buddha, the path to liberation, right? So the Buddhists would generally, especially in the Mahayana tradition, would ask that we check our motivation. Why are we living? What's the purpose of this life? And for the Buddhists, especially in the Mahayana tradition, the idea would be to achieve liberation, not only for one's own personal benefit, but in order to relieve the sufferings of others. So I find this a very useful sort of, you know, measure. Why am I doing this? Am I doing it for my own, you know, limited, you know, selfish personal interest, or am I doing it for some greater purpose? Am I, you know, going to feed myself, or am I going to feed, you know, 500 kids in India? You know, am I concerned about my own health, or am I going to be concerned about helping other people to be healthy? And what we find is that the wider, the greater our compassion, the more people that we allow into our sphere of interest, the happier we get. So check it out, you know, look around. But my experience has been people who are most concerned about themselves are the most miserable. And the people who are most concerned about others and doing something about it are the happiest. So maybe they're onto something.
Thank you.
Thank you, Venerable Lecture. That's a very important point to really sort of sit on and think about, even as we start our day, similar to the analogy or the way that the Buddhists or Tibetan Buddhists say that, you know, if you don't wake up meditating, then you wasted your day. I almost want to say in a similar way, if you don't wake up in your day thinking about how you may serve someone, then you may have wasted your day. I want to go to our next caller.
Good day, good evening, good morning. This is Michelle Ehlers calling in from San Jose in California. So happy with this call, so happy to be here. Thank you so much. I have a number of questions, actually. Let's see if I can bring it down. That first question was relating to the topic of death. I've had two near-death, really right up close death experiences, one when I was 13, and really just completely wiped out the memory of it. And somewhere along the line decided that I made a commitment to be conscious at the moment of death. And a couple of years ago, I was hit by a truck, and that actually happened coming out of meditation. And so I was wide awake and conscious, and it was amazing. And I didn't die, but I certainly had that experience of this is how it could be. This is really cool. And then I watched, helped with my father as he passed from Alzheimer's. And he was totally unaware at the moment of death. And I was there to make choices about putting him on medication because he was in a lot of pain. And I'd love to hear you speak about, you know, the being conscious of the moment of death in Alzheimer's and how that what you see about that and how we can prepare for that as well.
Well, we can't be sure that those who suffer from Alzheimer's are what kind of awareness they have. We don't have the instruments to measure that. And it's possible that they're not completely aware. But we don't know for certain. So there are a number of different ways to prepare for death. Meditation to be aware of the moment to moment, is really powerful, very important. It helps both to deal with all of the circumstances of illness and death, and it also helps us to be present at the moment of death. Maybe we won't be awake, maybe we won't be conscious, but ideally we would be. And then in that state of mind, we'd be able to guide our consciousness to whatever comes after, okay, which for the Buddhists and most people in South Asia would be another lifetime. But you don't want just any lifetime, right? I mean, because as a dog or a pig or a cockroach, you don't really have the best opportunity for furthering your spiritual practice. You'd like to be born as a human being in a situation where you can study and practice the Dharma, whatever path, you know, you have a karmic affinity with. And so that's why awareness is, you know, practicing, rehearsing for the moment of death by gaining concentration and perfect awareness moment to moment is so important. Also getting rid of the defilements, getting rid of anger, getting rid of attachment, getting rid of jealousy, getting rid of pride, all of these things will also be very, very important. That's what the Buddhists talk about when they talk about purifying the mind. I mean, it's like clearing out the garbage. And because you don't want those kinds of thoughts coming up at the last moment of death. That would not only be a distraction, it could lead you into an unfortunate state of rebirth. The other thing is to prepare by creating as much positive karma as possible. That would be, you know, by keeping good moral principles, you know, refraining from killing, refraining from stealing, refraining from lying, refraining from sexual misconduct. And then the Buddhists are going to throw in intoxicants there too, because often when we're intoxicant, if we're stoned or are drunk, we might break some of the other precepts. So they would try to follow those kinds of moral precepts and create as much positive to avoid doing unwholesome actions. And then at the same time, try to create as much wholesome karma as possible through acts of generosity and kindness and practice of patience and meditation and studying the teachings and all these wholesome actions. So all of that taken together, then, even if a person were an Alzheimer's patient and to all appearances is not conscious, they would still have a good store of merit, they call it. They will have accumulated all of these meritorious actions, which would help them to get a positive state of existence next time around. So maybe in the future we'll know more about what's going on. You know, at the moment we don't even know how to measure consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know, for the Buddhists, it's important not to disturb the person, the dying person, the dead person, because as long as their consciousness is present, we want them to be able to go through their process. If we start, you know, like moving them around or, you know, fighting over the estate or whatever, that could be very disturbing to the person. So we want to avoid that. Yeah.
Thank you. So I have another question at the global level, but I don't want, if there are other people waiting, I want to have give them a chance to ask a question.
That's okay, Michelle. You can go ahead. Well, actually, Venerable Lakshay, you know, I know that it's about 1:30 in the morning where you are right now, and so we wanted to know if you had a few minutes for a couple of more questions. We had some that came in online, and I know Michelle here has another question for you as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. We can go a bit longer.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Michelle.
Okay, great. So I've been fascinated in studying the entity humanity, the emergence of an awareness at the level of humanity, the organism, and I'm very involved in that and the spiritual development. Yes, I'm working my own personal spiritual development and that sort of the spiritual development of the entity humanity. And one of the things that I'm seeing that's very interesting to me as both a spiritual practitioner and an activist and trying to bring those together is the development of first the Millennium Development Goals and now the Sustainable Development Goals, which this time has been developed by the United Nations, but with more than 5 million people so far involved in that. And the Sustainable Development Goals will be addressing things like the equality for women and the opportunities for women and education for all and many of the issues that you have talked about. I'm just wondering if you see, you know, what you see as the possibility coming out of the SDGs and the relationship to other forms of activism and how that might be brought together or be interrelated in some fashion.
Well, I think this is really great. I think we have to work on every possible level. Humanity is really at a critical state right now. And we have to work both on the personal level, cleaning up our own personal garbage, you know, the garbage of the mind, and then improving our relationships with others and also improving our relationship with the earth. All of this is vitally important. Redressing the gender balance, vitally important. Trying to do something about our unjust, exploitative economic systems. I think, you know, we have to work on all of those levels. You know, wash out those plastic bags, you know. I mean, avoid them altogether if possible. Grow our own food. You know, just do everything we possibly can. You know, get our shower time down to 4 minutes. Do it all. You know, refuse plastic bottles. I mean, just go thirsty. But, you know, I think all of these things are important. They're symbolically important, and sometimes we feel like we're spitting in the wind, but, hey, we got to do something. We got to do everything possible for the good of the planet and the human species. Otherwise, it's not looking good, you know. So we got to improve our chances here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle, for your question. We had another question that came in online saying that, you know, you mentioned that anger is a huge no-no within Buddhism, yet this is something that most of us experience at some point or another, ranging from irritation to full-blown anger. How do you handle this in your own life?
Okay, that's really good. I think the caller is already on to the process in that irritation is a kind of low-grade anger. So the awareness that we develop in meditation helps us to become more aware of irritation as it begins to arise. That's really important. If we can be aware and notice when anger or irritation is arising, you know, usually it's about not getting what we want, right? And if we can notice that and prevent it from exploding into full-blown anger, we're doing great. So that's exactly what we need to do. Yep, and it comes through awareness. And again, practicing with it, there's no point in beating ourselves up if we blow it occasionally, but to try to get better at noticing the irritation as it starts to arise. Yeah, if we can catch it right in the beginning, we can avoid embarrassing ourselves. That's a very good thing.
That's great. We had one of our callers just comment saying, you know, thank you for sharing the Tibetan Buddhist practice and beliefs around meditating on death in the morning and the evening. It's such a precious reminder that we're dying with every moment, that we're not living fully. and it really resonates with me in a joyous way, far from being morbid. And so thank you for that. And then another question that came in is that you've been practicing meditation for so many decades. How do you feel your practice has changed over the years, if at all?
I think that I've become better at integrating the practice into daily life. Still beginner on the path, but I feel encouraged, inspired, in fact, to see that the meditation seems to be applying to everything. You know, I start out in the morning with some meditation and then some yoga, and then you go into the coffee ritual, right? And see every movement as a kind of meditation. So, you know, after things get busy and you start, you know, logging on and start getting out in the traffic, then it's more difficult. But in the early part of the day, if we can practice, use that as an opportunity for implementing, you know, integrating our sitting meditation into our everyday activities, walking up the stairs. So they say in the Zen tradition, when walking, walk, when sitting, sit, while eating, eat, right? Using every activity as a meditation practice. Then it will just start to become natural. It'll get easier and easier as we go along. So that's what I found, and I find it really encouraging to see that, you know, yeah, things do get better.
Thank you. We had another caller write in and asking, you know, how can we donate to Venerable Lekshe's projects, and are there any things that we can do to help other than financial as well?
Oh, well, that's very kind. I appreciate that very much. We have a website, and if you go to jamyang.org, it's jamyang.org. And on there, there's a donate button. And so that's the way to do it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And how about ways we can help that are not financial related?
Right. Okay. Then we do have a volunteer program as well. We have opportunities for volunteers to go to the Himalayas and to volunteer teaching English, teaching math, social studies, environmental awareness, healthcare, all kinds of things. Sometimes we have medical teams come over. We just had one from Taiwan. They brought 4 laptops. Now the nuns can study, you know, English by a CD during the winter months. This is really wonderful. So then we also have one center where it's not in the Himalayas, it's in Bodh Gaya. So in the winter months too, the nuns come down from the mountains and they stay there and study for, you know, 4 or 5 months. So we need teachers there as well. So donations of, you know, laptops are also welcome. We've had people come over and build a classroom. Last winter, an American young man came over to teach English, and he saw that they didn't have a proper classroom. So he just rounded up the resources, got some donations, and built a beautiful thermal kind of room so that, you know, with double glass and all of that, so that they can stay warm in the winter. So there are lots and lots of different things. We would really love to have a team of dentists come out. That's a little more challenging, but yeah, all these kinds of things.
Wonderful. I wanted to turn things back over to you, Pavita, to see if you had any other remaining questions or wanted to wrap up.
I do have a question. And it's in the vein of just wanting to hear a story, one last story from Venerable Lekshe before we end this call. And that was to ask if there's any particular story from the Buddha's life
or from any of the other bodhisattvas that you find particularly inspiring?
Oh, so many stories. Yeah. Well, I love the story of the Buddha when he was mediating a dispute on the Rohini River. And he was able to bring the two conflicting sides together. It sort of predates all the nonviolent communication skills by about 2.5 millennia, where he could get the two sides of the conflict to address the problem together. And I think that if human beings were able to look at problem solving this way, that it's not, you know, me against you or us against them or our country against the world, we could see the problem as a challenge that we can all solve together. So not, you know, climate change exists and doesn't exist and choose up teams and, you know, fight each other. No. Climate change is something we need to address together. How can we do it best? How can we pool all of our resources? So this story from the Buddha I find very powerful. That's a good one. Oh, so many stories.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I know it is closing in on 2 a.m. your time. We are so grateful for how generously and beautifully you've shared from your experience and your remarkable insights. It's as I think about, you know, the intersection that your journey has played out on, it brings together such a unique combination of things, you know, working for women in the kind of the Buddhist feminism approach, the historical kind of biases that your work seeks to correct, the education element in it, the ecology element that you just touched on. It seems like you've just given us so many nuggets to hold in our pockets as we each continue on our paths. And for me, I think that, you know, that reminder that every day that we spend without reflecting on our mortality and without reflecting on our capacity to give, we lose out something tremendously precious. Is something I want to.
We're all interconnected, right? It's so important to remember that we all depend upon each other. None of us could live independently of each other. And so seeing the whole, you know, the body of humanity as a whole is, and including the animals, right, including the environment. That's why it's all wrapped up together, the economy and the political and, you know, the social and the personal. We tend to put them in different compartments, but it's all interconnected. So one last thing I'd like to give the website for Sakyadita as well, because some people might be interested in learning more about the conference in Indonesia or just in general the work that we've been doing, which is Sakyadita, SakyaDhita.org. So SakyaDhita.org.
And we will be emailing that out to all of the people on the call today, as well as sharing.
Oh, very kind of you. Thanks so much for giving me this opportunity and for all your good work in putting the call together. It's a great service to the community.
The gratitude is definitely mutual. And in that spirit of interconnection that you touched upon, we like to end the call with a moment of silent gratitude as well, and just knowing that we're all in it together, and that as we purify ourselves, that beams out into the world in beautiful ways. So we'll take a minute in silence, and then we have a tradition of unmuting everybody on the call for the final moment so that they can express their gratitude in a chorus of thank yous. So we will go into a minute of silence now. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Venerable Lakshay, once again.